Yeah, first I'd like to say that it's great to have a student that takes care of all the work here. So I came up with the idea of some of the speakers, but I just got to sit back and relax while O'Neill took care of all the work. So that was much appreciated. What I'm going to talk about today is basically tying up some of the loose ends that Neil was not able to discuss in his 20 minutes. And I think of the four speakers that talked about Lepidoptera so far, I'm going to discuss at least three of their, or at least refer to at least three of those speakers' results. So basically, it's the next step, and here we go. So the the outline, first I'm going to do a very quick, maybe a minute or two of revisiting Anil's results to get you up to speed with what I'm going to be discussing today. Probably the most important part of the talk will be about MVP2 selection and the results we saw and interpretation of some of these results. I'll briefly talk about the fitness costs, although Anil's going to be presenting most of those tomorrow, which I will elaborate on. Then, of course, addressing Eve's question before his talk on what happens to these insects on BT cotton, and then with some concluding remarks. So very quickly going over Neil's results, this is the first report of stable and moderate to high levels of cryo-NA resistance in Zaya. And you know, just in this passing, our paper just got published, and we felt very proud of this paper. It took us about 4 years worth of work to do. And we got our comments back from the viewers, and they wanted 10 to 20 years worth of work. So you know, this is a very difficult insect to develop resistance to, and so certainly we do not have the high levels of resistance, and we've just started characterizing, so many of the questions that you may ask, we probably will be able to answer in another 5 or 10 or even 20 years. But we believe that selecting for resistance of this insect is pretty important because it's one of the major target pests of BT cotton, but it's also a pest of, and target pest of cryo-NA B corn, both field and sweet corn, especially sweet corn. What we think is important too is that resistance could be achieved with cryo-NA C toxin, but not MVP2. So again, this whole idea of what form of the cryo-NA C you use is becoming very important. And I think certainly more important with the Zaya in particular. What is interesting, which will also tie into the differences between MVP2 and 1AC, is that we found negligible cross-resistance with cryo-NAB corn, which also sort of surprised us. And the fact that we found that there was no binding differences between these between the susceptible and the resistant insects, which also sort of goes against what most people find for resistance to 1AC, at least in Lepidoptera. So turning into MVP2 selection. The reason why this is important, the reason why we wanted to do this type of work, is that MVP2 is the primary selection agent that has been used, certainly in the US and even outside of the US, for developing 1AC resistant Lepidoptera. So we want to certainly get on the bandwagon and do the same thing. As Anil had also mentioned, that MVP2 is the cryo-1AC product that is used for monitoring. So if we're going to be monitoring for field resistance with 1AC in the form of MVP2, then we better make sure that this is actually our resistant insects will be sensitive to this. And I think what Anil also alluded to is that this is an insect that labs, including my own, have been trying to select for resistance for at least 10 years, most of which we've been using MVP2. When I've been doing this for the last 6 years myself, I thought that I must be doing something wrong. But then after talking with NC State and Randy Luttrell at University of Arkansas, they're all having the same difficulty. So there's something unique that's happening with Zaya that does not happen apparently with these other insects. So very briefly, when we talk about MVP2 resistance and selection and the results I'm going to share, I just want to point out that all of these were done at the same time. So when we selected for resistance to MVP2 or 1AC, and when we also reared our susceptible insects, they were all done at the same time under the same conditions using the same methodologies. So very briefly, this is Anil published or talked about with 1AC activated toxin, but I just want to just talk about the blue, where you see after 7 generations we already got 35-fold resistance, and after 11 we shot up very quickly to over 120. But if you look what happens with MVP2 selection, so we have 7 generations which we had in both we actually looked at resistance studies for these two different colonies at the same generation, and we go from 123 down to 12, okay? And again, we lost this colony after 9 to 11 generations. And again, there were fecundity and fertility problems. We lost the strain after 11 generations. But this wasn't unexpected, because this is what I have found for many years, and this is what the group at NC State that has continued on it with Ryan Jackson at USD in Stoneville, we all see this. So it's not unexpected, but we see this result here, but we did not see that with 1AC. So there's definitely differences. Well, one of the really interesting, I think, questions to ask is, well, if they are different or if they're not different, then if you challenge 1AC toxin-resistant insects with MVP2 and they're the same, then you should get cross-resistance. So we did this. The pointer has disappeared. Let's see. Yeah. So basically, this is the generation. This is the resistance ratio, or the number or the amount of resistance. And you can see that after seven generations, we saw a resistance ratio of 5. At 123-fold resistance to the 1AC toxin, we found about 8-fold. And basically, with the same level, we found 10-fold, which means we saw 10-fold less cross-resistant to MVP2 than expected. To put this in a more of a graphic way, or certainly a different way, is one of the things we always wanted to do when we want to try to compare MVP2 and 1AC, what you always see is about a 2 to 3-fold increase in tolerance to the protoxin than the toxin, which makes sense if, in fact, you have to activate the toxin, you would lose basically half of the weight, so you'd expect to have a 2 to 3-fold increase in amount needed to get the same type of toxicity, which is what we see here. However, just the opposite is true with the resistant strain. Again, this resistant strain is resistant to 1AC toxin. When you challenge this with MVP2, you get just the opposite effect, that the insects are now more susceptible to MVP2 than they are to the activated toxin. Okay, so questions to ask about this, because obviously when you work with an activated toxin and you work with a formulated product, there's all sorts of can of worms in that formulation that could be contributing to some of these differences. So we could ask, what compounds in MVP2 prevent resistance evolution and do not provide high cross resistance to Cry1AC toxin? First question you can ask is, well, are we using the same toxin? And the answer is yes, that there's no difference. So the Cry1AC toxin in MVP2 is in fact 100% homologous to the one that we used. Are there other compounds in MVP2? Obviously, in formulations, it's sort of a black box. We don't know many of these formulated materials. But what we did is we took some of this MVP2 and we autoclaved it for 30 minutes. We know that MVP2 protects the toxin from degradation, protects from heat, but we figured 30 minutes in an autoclave is pretty stringent. We tested this against susceptible insects and we saw no activity. But when you use the level of MVP2 formulation that we needed for our high levels of resistance, which is basically 3 to 4 milligrams per gram of diet, we already saw stunting. So we actually saw formulation effect with these high levels against our susceptible insects. So is Cry1AC toxin resistant Zaya totally cross-resistant to protoxin? No. So what could be some conclusions or interpretations of this data? First, there's certainly the suggestion that there are interactions with the 1AC and MVP2 with other types of formulated material. However, as Anil has shown, MVP2 does contain the inclusion bodies of 1AC. Therefore, solubilization certainly could be one step that's involved with this lack of resistance. Resistance to the toxin and not the protoxin suggests that the protoxin may be protecting the toxin from degradation, such as proteolysis. So if you think about this, I call this the anti-operate. Okay, so with Brenda's work, she showed that insects were protease-resistant or protease-mediated resistance. These insects were resistant to the protoxin, but not the toxin. Our insects are resistant to the toxin, but not the protoxin, which means the protoxin has to go through all the normal stages of events and still be toxic. So that's a paradox that I don't know how to explain, except that proteolysis seems like a pretty good explanation right now. Getting into the monitoring aspects, because we know that MPP2 is certainly different than what we're seeing with 1-AC toxin, and assuming that 1-AC toxin is the primary form of 1-AC that's in the in BT cotton, that the resistance monitoring methodologies for at least this insect, we're only talking about Zaya here, they should carefully consider the form of 1-AC that's being used. Taking this one step further, Anil talked about what has happened with 1-AB expressing corn powder. And yes, we did see significant difference, but it was very slight. Nothing major at all. Okay? So we saw high levels of resistance to the toxin, but not to the protoxin in the corn itself. Okay? However, this corn tissue, and this is getting back sort of to what Brenda was saying in this symposium, that when you take freeze-dried, so this corn powder we got from Monsanto was freeze-dried. So when you freeze-dry, you basically are inactivating these enzymes. So we believe that although there could be activation of these proteases in the plant, that by immediately freeze-drying the tissue, these proteases were not able to actually activate the toxin. Okay. Also, too, changes in proteolysis could potentially explain why AR was only partially resistant to these tissues. So again, proteolysis seems to rear its ugly head here again. The fact that we do not see any differences in any of the binding parameters that we've looked at so far, and we've done some other experiments in the lab that we cannot discuss right now, it certainly looks like, it's got to be something other than a binding, and it looks like proteolysis would be our number one candidate. So getting into finally answering Eve's question of about an hour ago, let's take these insects and put them on BT plants. Other people have done this a lot earlier than we have. We had to go through Monsanto and get permission, and that took us a lot longer to do. We looked at BT, DPL-555, and the 491 as close of an isoline parent as we could get. Instead of using greenhouse plants, we went in the field. We grew these north of Montgomery in Alabama. So these are real plants. We collected squares after that were on plants greater than 85 days, and were tested in the laboratory. The Cry1-AC expression was quantified by Monsanto. Now, this should be important anyway, I think, from an experimental design standpoint. But for those of you that work in cotton or have been in the Southeast this last year, this was the worst drought in probably 50, maybe 100 years, or maybe more. So we were really concerned that this drought was going to have an impact on toxin expression. We also did this over a period of almost 2 weeks in the laboratory, so we were worried about toxin expression degrading in squares after they had been excised. I'm pleased to report that both from the field and from the walk-in or from refrigeration, there was no drop in toxin expression at all. So we were quite pleased with this. Okay, and for all the tests that we conducted, our AR, our resistant line, was between 100 and 150 fold resistant to the 1-AC toxin for all the replicates that we tested. So when you look at a standard 7-day bioassay of putting these insects, neonate larvae, on squares after a 7-day bioassay, you see that you get very little mortality with either the susceptible or the control line on non-BT, the 491. When you put the resistant insects on there, you start getting higher mortality, but significantly less than the susceptible insects. So you can say that, look, we actually have higher survival of our resistant insects, which is obviously good. It sort of validates what we've been thinking we've been doing as far as selecting for resistance. However, this doesn't tell the whole story. What happens after this? If these insects are still surviving after 7 days, if you can keep replacing the tissue, what happens after 7 days? So we took that. So Anil took this over to a month, spent a lot of time on this. And what you see is that here you actually get, you got probably 50% control mortality in your susceptible and your resistant insects feeding on non-BT cotton. So you have a high control mortality. And of course, you would expect that all the susceptible insects on your BT cotton would die, which they do, but in sort of getting into some of the fitness costs that Eves was talking about, even our resistant insects ultimately died on BT cotton. So yes, we do get increased survivorship, but ultimately, we do get insects that stay longer on the plant. They actually go to at least one more instar, but ultimately they still die on the plant. Okay? And we got none that could pupate. So, although the resistant insects can survive better on BT cotton than susceptible insects, again, this validates our resistance. And when we started selecting with 1-AC toxin, which we think is the right way to go, but it's tough. It's really tough to use toxin. We think that this result certainly validates the resistance, that selecting for toxin resistance and our insects can survive on plants means that either there's resistance to toxin or protoxin, which we don't see, suggesting, again, getting back to what Brenda was saying, suggesting that at least some of the form of the protein in the plant is in fact toxin. But even with that, our survivorship on these plants with our resistant insects, which was much less than expected. And remember, we're dealing with an insect here that typically has some survivorship on, at least with high populations on BT cotton anyway. So here we have insects that are relatively tolerant to BT cotton, and yet they still can't survive, even with 100 to 150 fold resistance. Okay. What we would also say, though, is that contrary to other reports of survivorship, that you really need to, if you're going to make prognostications for in models as far as fitness costs and resistance, then you should rear these insects as far as you can on these plants. So we think that conducting bioassays for the entire larval duration is certainly, I think, a step in the right direction. One reason that you could certainly argue that these insects might have had a little bit of difficulty surviving on plants is, in fact, if there was protoxin. So we showed that with amphipe-2, our insects do have a problem with it. So the more protoxin that's in the plant, the less survivorship I would expect to see on these plants. Okay. And as Eves has said, that we do have secondary plant compounds in these plants, such as gossypol, and certainly I would have no problem accepting secondary plant or plant BT interactions as some mechanisms of reducing the fitness of our resistant insects on these plants. Taking this a little bit further, very recent results by Henneberry and Yek, and I think Jeff Fabric, I was talking to Bruce Tabashnik about this very recently, and there's a new strain of pink bollworm that has been selected for resistance using BT cotton, in which they find no adult survivorship, and incidentally, there's no modification in cadherin. Remember, we see no binding differences in our strain at all, and we've went more specifically for cadherin, and also have seen no suggestion that any cadherin-based resistance is present. So this suggests that selection using at least partial activated toxin, which we agree is what we've selected for and what would be in cotton with this study up here, does not result in alteration of cadherin. And it also suggests that selection using BT cotton tissue is more difficult to obtain resistance than when selected on diet. Now, I want us to go very briefly into some of the fitness cost data that Anil has generated, which is more, I think, more appropriate for the theme of my talk. But I want to point out and give a plug for Anil. He was not satisfied with giving a symposia talk. He wants to give a student competition presentation as well. So tomorrow morning at 10:53, this is the number, he's going to be giving a full 10-minute, very streamlined, very neat presentation on fitness costs, and I would certainly welcome you to attend that. But in the two or three slides I'm going to discuss here, I'd like to point out that this was conducted over many generations, in some cases more than 1 to 2 years, where we compared both the control or susceptible insects as well as our cryo-resistant Zea. And in this presentation, I'm only going to talk about comparing sex ratio, pupil mortality, and percent mating, just as three parameters as far as fitness costs. So if you look at the proportion of males, and again, notice this is January 06 versus June of 07, so about a year and a half, you notice that this upper line here is for the resistant insects, the lower line is for the control. And what you see is a male by a sex ratio, which suggests that you have fewer females in the resistant line to contribute to the next generation. If you look at increased pupil mortality, you notice that in the resistant line you have a higher level of mortality, which suggests that there are fewer adults to contribute to the next generation. And for reduction in mating, if you look at all three of these parameters, percent mating, percent multiple mating, the number of spermatophores per male, you notice that they're all significantly reduced in the resistant insects. So, three more slides to go. So, and Anil gets to take credit for these last two slides. So, when we think about what is the potential for Zea to develop resistance to BT cotton, we believe it has many obstacles. You have a male bias, fewer total number of eggs, fewer viable adults, increased pupil mortality, mating problems. When you have high populations of Zea, you typically use pyrethroid oversprays, and Anil has shown that there's not cross-resistance to those. We've already got our second generation of BT cotton out, Bolgar 2, and hopefully next year or two, Vipcot. So we have what's called the power of the pyramid, and this is something that I was asked, you notice here at the science, this last edition of Science, I was asked to comment on the paper by Soberone on the CRY1AC mod protein, overcoming resistance to cadherin-based resistance. And we called it the power of the pyramid, but compared to my article, we decided to change this pyramid and basically talk about the BT proteins for BT cotton. So we started in 96 with 1AC. 2002, 2003, we added 2AB. In 05, we added 1F. Hopefully in a year or two, we'll add VIP3A, CRY1AC mod, and probably others in probably a couple years after that. So if we have all, if we haven't seen resistance to a single gene product yet, and we have all of these that are already out and upcoming, the question I would ask is, how much do we need to worry about Zea resistance to BT cotton? And I think that after you see Anil's talk with Fitness Cost tomorrow, that will probably help answer that question for you. The last slide I'd like to leave you with is basically, we tried using this term before as a new twist in BT resistance. And what I'd like to point out is that I think this is the last new insect, at least Lepidoptera, since maybe 5 years ago with Trichoplusia knee. And every new BT resistant species changes the BT resistance paradigm. So every time we find a new insect, we probably select differently, use a different protein, but we always find something different. What's sort of different, and these you could sort of lump these together as four different characteristics. We have a narrow spectrum of resistance, but it's not linked to binding, which would be expected. We have 150-fold resistant cotton bollworm that should survive on BT cotton and it can't. We have extraordinary fitness costs linked to resistance. And well, we haven't showed you data for, but work that a new postdoc of mine, Jayadevi, has been doing, inheritance of resistance is certainly incompletely dominant and certainly going more towards a dominance. So these are things that are different than many other CRY1AC resistant insects. And with that, I'd just like to point out that what I would implore you for those of you that have 5 or 10 years to spare, we need more resistant insects to help answer some of these questions so we can get a much more generalized picture on resistance. And again, I'd like to recognize sponsors for this research, USDA and Cotton Incorporated. And I'm the last speaker, so I do have time to answer questions, I hope. Yes, sir. Well, isn't that the million-dollar question? The working hypothesis we have is that that the 1AC toxin, with a highly prolificous insect that feeds on many different plants, we believe that its proteolytic capability is enormous. You know, there may be hundreds of different proteases involved, and it all has to do with select for one. So we believe that the protoxin protects the toxin until it gets into the midgut. So if you feed it activated toxin, it's basically naked as it goes from the the mouth all the way into the midgut, and would be very prone to different types of proteolysis from many different enzymes. Any other questions? Thanks for hanging around. I appreciate all the talks from different speakers, and I think we had a very good and varied presentation this afternoon. Thank you very much.